This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Amid ongoing scandals and potential scandals in Washington, national security and terrorism are back at the top of the news today. We'll look at some bizarre developments in the already twisted story of the Boston Marathon bombers, as well as a gruesome murder in London that authorities there say they're calling that a terrorist attack as well. But first, since the attacks of September 11th in 2001, terrorism has dominated the foreign policy agenda. Today, in a major speech at the National Defense University, President Obama is going to refocus the nation's counterterrorism strategy, shifting the drone program that we've heard so much about from the CIA to the Department of Defense, and forecasting what he hopes could be an end to the war on terror itself. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about new moves the president says he's going to make to release longtime prisoners at Guantanamo Bay as part of this overall strategy. But last night, for the first time, Attorney General Eric Holder, in a letter, confirmed that the United States drone strikes have killed four American citizens. In September of 2011, a targeted strike killed radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen. According to Holder, three other Americans who died in that strike and in other attacks, quote, were not specifically targeted, end quote. Now, for more on the implications of this shift in the policy of drone strikes, we turn to Mike Azenko. He's Douglas Dillon Fellow at the College on Foreign Relations and author of Politics, Power, and Preventative Action blog. Micah, hi.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Well, first, what does it mean for the administration to have done what everybody's talking about, which is acknowledging the killing of four American citizens by drone strikes? We all knew about Awlaki, even though it hadn't been officially acknowledged. It was the biggest open secret in the country that this American citizen had been targeted and killed by his own country, but three others as well. What does it mean to finally have our government acknowledge that these killings took place?
Well, it's about being accountable for the actions that you undertake on behalf of the U.S. citizens. As you pointed out correctly, the only revelation yesterday was Jude Kenan Muhammad, who was an American citizen, was killed in Pakistan. Everyone else who was in the letter from Attorney General Eric Holder to Congress yesterday was already well known. So in a sense, this is the administration's efforts to largely make transparent what is already publicly available information in order to sort of claim that they're continuing their engaged dialogue with Congress, with the public, and their commitment to transparency. But there was really nothing new in that memo, because most of what we knew about the principles by which they could conduct these strikes and the individuals who had been killed and the fact that three of them had been killed accidentally, we've known for over a year.
Okay, so the cloak of transparency, if you will, is sort of cast over some things that we probably already knew. But another big part of this, Mike Azenko, is doing what a lot of people in Washington have been calling for a while, I think including you, which is shifting the drone program away from the CIA and into the Department of Defense, making the drone program purely military. Is that a good idea? What does that really mean to the policy? What does that mean to targeting alleged terrorists?
It is potentially a good move if the president and the secretary of defense support the principles of transparency and openness, which cannot occur under the CIA. And under U.S. law, a covert action conducted by the CIA are operations which cannot be acknowledged or defended publicly. So, for example, when the United States conducts drone strikes in Pakistan, the U.S. ambassador can in no way there articulate what the United States is doing. Subsequently, the Pakistani military and Pakistani militants are essentially conducting America's strategic communications campaign in Pakistan. They articulate what's happening with drones, largely much of which is myths and misinformation, whereas if these were Department of Defense operations, you can acknowledge them. So the other problem is there's this split between who has what's called lead executive authority in which country. So, for example, in Pakistan, all drone strikes are conducted by the CIA. In Somalia, all of them are conducted by the military. And in Yemen, some are conducted by the CIA and some are conducted by the military. So there's questions of why you need parallel drone programs between the CIA and the military when if you're committed to being more transparent and open about these operations, you can only do it through the military. You cannot do it through the CIA.
We shouldn't be confused, though, Mike Azenko, am I right, that this means that the Secretary of Defense or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs are going to run around proclaiming every single military drone strike that kills somebody who we think is a terrorist?
Well, currently, the director of the CIA personally signs off on every single drone strike. So this was under the procedures that were developed early on in the Obama administration. So Michael Hayden and then Leon Panetta and then David Petraeus and then Michael Morrell and now John Brennan, they have to personally sign off on every single drone strike. So we're not sure what will be the rules of authorization if the military takes hold. It's very interesting that when Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel had all of his hearings to become the Pentagon secretary, nobody asked him one question about U.S. targeted killings when so many people made that the focus of John Brennan's hearings. And now it turns out John Brennan might not have any oversight or authorization role in these.
And it may all go to Hagel at the Secretary of Defense. Well, I mentioned, Michael Zenko, before we let you go, that the president seems to hope that this shift in policy with targeted killings, tightening up standards for who can be targeted, shifting it to the military and so forth, portends an end to what we know of as the war on terror. Can you explain relatively briefly how we get from here to the end of the war on terror? What does that mean?
Well, it's almost inconceivable to do this because last week in a very disheartening Senate hearing, senior Pentagon officials acknowledged that they believe they have the authorization to use military force against anyone that they say is an affiliated force of al-Qaeda, and they will not provide a list of who those consist of. They claim they can conduct these operations anywhere on Earth. They also claim that they can conduct these strikes. Senator Lindsey Graham asked a Pentagon official, so these might go on for 10 to 20 years. And the Pentagon official said yes. So if President Obama is now going to try to bring to a close the practice of non-battlefield targeted killings, which the United States has been engaged in since November 2002, again, 50 drone strikes under President Bush, over 375 and counting under President Obama, this would have to be a remarkable speech that can justify why the president is going to call an end to the war on terror, which the people who are implementing it say could go on for another two decades.
Major shifts potentially in U.S. drone policy from the president of the United States, a policy that he relies on in what we have come to know as the war on terror. Mike Zenko is Douglas Dillon Fellow at the College on Foreign Relations and author of Politics, Power, and Preventive Action. Thank you, Michael. Micah.
Thank you.
Well, today, as President Obama refocuses the nation's counterterrorism policies, he's also going to address the ongoing efforts to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Cuba. Now, the president ordered the military prison closed when he first took office back in January 2009 and confronted a Congress, Republicans and Democrats that said no. They blocked it on several levels. Now the president hopes to send many of the prisoners in Guantanamo, particularly from Yemen, back to their home countries. And he plans to appoint a State Department official to oversee those transfers. Joining us is Jennifer Daskal, a fellow at the Center on Law and National Security at Georgetown University Law Center. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, as I mentioned, the president has confronted a big flat no from Congress on his election promise to close Guantanamo Bay. We have heard that he plans to take some prisoners, a couple dozen, I guess, particularly from Yemen, and repatriate them back. What do we know about how that's going to work?
Well, at this point, we don't know a whole lot of details, but what we can expect is that while Congress has, to a large extent, stymied his efforts to close Guantanamo, they have granted him a so-called national security waiver on restrictions of transfers out, which allow him to allow the Secretary of Defense to waive some of the restrictions based on assertions of certain security conditions being met and transfer detainees out of Guantanamo. There are, of the 166 detainees still in Guantanamo, there are 86 that have been cleared for transfer or what's called conditional transfer based on conditions in Yemen. And so my guess is that the administration will start with some subset of those, transfer them back to Yemen, see what happens, work with the Yemeni government. The new Yemeni government is a government that this administration has a very good relationship with. And hopefully we will start seeing some movement on Guantanamo.
Now, Jennifer Daskal, you said see what happens when they're transferred back to Yemen. You and I both know that lots of people, American citizens and members of Congress, are really worried about that see what happens. What if they return to the battlefield? How might we track these folks, stay next to them to see if they become terrorists again or join the fight?
So all of these transfers take place with a combination of security guarantees and humane treatment guarantees. And by security guarantees, the U.S. presumably works with the host nation, with Yemen in this case, to put in place a range of possible so-called solutions, including surveillance mechanisms, monitoring mechanisms. It's possible that they would set up some sort of rehabilitation center to deal with some of these individuals. And so, you know, with a combination of monitoring and surveillance and other tools at both governments' disposal, I think, you know, it's likely, it's hopeful that there are ways to keep tabs on most of these men. Now, we don't live in a risk-free world, and we can't expect to live in a risk-free world. We accept risk every time we release somebody from prison. We accept risk every time we release somebody on bail. And so at some point, there needs to be some acceptance of risk if this goal of closing Guantanamo is to take place. And the president, along with Senator McCain and many others, have talked about the national security interest in closing Guantanamo.
We're basically talking about a situation where a detainee, in this case from Yemen, would be sent back to his home country, but not free in the sense of being, sure, freed from Guantanamo, but not freed in the sense of having complete, you know, sort of self-determination. This person would be closely watched by the Yemenis and certainly by us.
Presumably. I mean, again, we don't know any of the details, but that would be my guess, that there would, at a minimum, be some sort of monitoring in place.
Well, Jennifer Daskal, before we let you go, you know, we started then talking about the closing of Guantanamo, but the president is talking about this today. Congress has made it clear, right, that they don't want Guantanamo closed. There are about half of these detainees, or a third of them, that can be transferred, but we're not really talking about closing the prison, are we?
Well, the president has said that that's his goal. I mean, nobody should be fooled. Doing so is not easy. That's why it's taken, the president promised to do so in a year, and now we are 5 years later. But there are, as I said, of the 166 detainees, there are 86 that have been cleared for transfer, conditional transfer. That's the easiest place to start. There's some subset that are slated for prosecution. And the other thing that I'm hopeful that we'll hear from the president today is that he's going to start up these so-called periodic review boards, which were promised to begin approximately a year ago, that would do annual reviews biannual reviews of the detainees' threat level to determine if any of the remaining detainees, the threat has been sufficiently mitigated that the administration feels safe enough in transferring them out. And with a combination of those measures, I mean, my hope is that you can significantly reduce the size of the Guantanamo population. And at some point, the legal authority for holding these guys will no longer be there. The only reason that the administration is able to hold these men in Guantanamo is pursuant to the ongoing armed conflict between the United States, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. And if that conflict is over, then there's no longer any authority for holding them.
Jennifer Daskal is a senior fellow at the Center on Law and National Security at Georgetown University Law Center. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's been a mystifying and deadly development in the investigation into who or what motivated and maybe helped the Boston Marathon bombing suspects planned their attack. An FBI agent shot and killed a Chechen man named Ibrahim Todashev in Orlando yesterday. Now, Todashev apparently knew Tamerlan Tsarnaev, he's the older brother suspected of the Boston bombing, through the world of martial arts. Now, his friends say Todashev had no knowledge of those attacks. Listen.
All it was about is about him knowing the guy, the Tamerlan, and talking to him on the phone, I think month before the bombing. That's it. You know what I mean? But the Tamerlan, those two guys, they kept it in a secret.
That was Kusein Tamarov, a friend of Todashev's, speaking to reporters. But the FBI does say that before he was killed yesterday, Todashev confessed to an unsolved triple homicide in Waltham, Massachusetts, and that Tamerlan Tsarnaev helped with those grisly murders. For more on this story, I'm joined by Philip Martin, senior investigative reporter for The Takeaway's partner, WGBH in Boston. Hi, Philip.
Yeah, Todd, how are you? I think twisted is a good way to describe the story.
And so we have to start in Florida. FBI agents, state troopers, and others were in the apartment, apparently, of Ibrahim Todashev questioning him. Then what happened?
Well, this was a surprising development. I do know that the FBI and state police here in Massachusetts have been all over the country talking to people connected in various ways to the bombing suspect, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and his brother, Zohar. And what happened in Florida is that the FBI went to question this Chechen man, Ibrahim Todashev, who has connections with Tsarnaev here in the Boston area. They basically were practicing mixed martial arts at the Y Crew gym, which is a very well-known martial arts studio, not far from WGBH's studios, in fact. FBI and the state police went to question him, and they, according to the FBI, things were going along well. During the questioning, at some point, Todashev admitted or was said to admit to taking part in this unsolved triple murder in Waltham, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston, a very grisly murder where the three suspects were stabbed in the throat. Marijuana was left on their bodies, as was $5,000 left in the open. And when this happened, the FBI said that the suspect, the person of interest, I should say, Mr. Todashev, suddenly pulled out a knife, according to the FBI, and started to attack the FBI agent, who reached for his revolver and reportedly shot the suspect.
Now, the FBI says that before they shot and killed him because the interview turned violent, that Todashev acknowledged a hand in this grisly triple murder, and that Tsarnaev helped him. Now, this wasn't the first that we had heard that Tsarnaev was suspected of having helped in that murder. I've certainly heard implications of that in the past, but this seems to be the strongest evidence to date that that is, in fact, the case, that he helped in this grisly triple murder.
Well, Todd, again, a lot of this won't be ascertained until the forensics are in and there's more, until the Middlesex County District Attorney, which is leading this investigation with the FBI, until their findings are made. But you're right. This is very, very strong suggestion that what had been suspected by family members of the deceased, that he may have played a role. They brought this to the attention of the FBI and the state police after this unsolved murder had gone on for a year and a half, and after the Boston Marathon bombing, because they knew that Tsarnaev was a close friends with Brendan Meth. And so they suggested that the FBI take a closer look. This was after the bombing. When they did, a number of things had been dripping out. Let me put it this way. The case remained absolutely baffling to individuals. Jack Cole, a retired New Jersey State Police officer, now living in the Boston area, well, he didn't work on this case. He points to his 14 years as an undercover narcotics detective for perspective.
If what is true about the three victims being found on the floor with marijuana sprinkled all over their bodies and $5,000 in plain view left there, that's pretty unusual for anybody that's dealing in drugs to do those sort of things.
So he suspected something other than just a drug deal. The FBI says that Todashev implicated himself in Tsarnaev, Philip Martin, but the authorities there in Waltham, Massachusetts don't consider this case closed, right?
Oh, far from it. They feel they need to look a lot deeper into the background of the deceased, both Tsarnaev and now Todashev, but they also have to check forensic evidence to see how this matches up. One of the other baffling aspects of this case, and the reason the former district attorney, Jerry Leone, suggested at the time of the homicide that it had to be several people, is because of the individuals in question. All of them were connected largely by martial arts, obviously not by religion. Brendan Meth was a martial artist, a mixed martial artist, and his friend Raphael Teakin, one of the dead men, was also a mixed martial artist, and they were in great shape. Here's what Gary McKayse says, who's a Waltham City Councilor who represents the neighborhood where the murders took place, said about his friend Raphael Teakin.
You could see that he was in shape. Even in the winter, when he had a jacket on, you could see that the young man was muscular. So that says a lot about the murders. I think three young, you know, healthy, strong young men were taken out quietly. It had to have been either several men or assassins.
Philip, seems like in this case there are just as many questions opened as have been answered. What looks like a drug deal also took place on September 11th, and there are just a lot more questions to be answered about this murder that Tamerlan Tsarnaev is apparently connected to.
Multiple questions, including the relationship between again, Tsarnaev and Todashev in relationship to mixed martial arts and relationship to this brutal killing in Waltham. Did, in fact, they do it? That's the mystery.
A grisly and strange twist in the unfolding story of the Boston bombings. Philip Martin, senior investigative reporter for the Takeaways Partner at WGBH in Boston. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
This is The Takeaway. Well, in a commencement speech on a beautiful, sunny spring day or in the middle of raging downpours, one thing stands out, and it becomes clear when you watch the eager faces of the crowd from the speaker's podium. To those parents and students seated in the audience, boom, you get it. The one thing standing between them and graduation and the party or the family dinner after graduation is the commencement speaker trying to impart to the young people who are just there starting their lives. How do you hold their attention? Well, maybe it takes a real miracle.
I was never expected to speak again, let alone to be standing up here right now to speak to you. I am a walking miracle. Life can change in an instant. I'm living proof of that.
Award-winning journalist Bob Woodruff is a walking miracle of sorts. Nearly blown to smithereens in Iraq while covering the war in 2006, his recovery took years, but he gave last year's commencement speech at Boston College, where he reportedly rocked the house, we're told. But Bob, being a skeptical journalist, is dubious about these notices. Who remembers commencement speeches anyway, he asks. The fact was that first line in his speech in Boston. And he admitted to us that he didn't remember his commencement speech when he graduated from Colgate, even though that speaker would later become a colleague of his and a friend.
Koppel was mine that did mine back there in 1983, and I told him I never remembered a single word that he said. I told him that, and he said, well, he got his back in Syracuse in 1961 when he graduated, Ted Koppel, and he still couldn't even remember exactly who it was, let alone what they said. All he would tell me was that he was naked underneath his gown. So he just wanted to tell me that interesting story. I said, are you okay if I tell that story to someone else? And he said,
hang on, is that true, or are you just having fun with Koppel?
No, that's true. That's what he said was true. And I mean, I was born in 1961 when he graduated, so I don't remember it at all. But he certainly was open about it. And Ted, if you're listening now, just I'm telling it again. Why not?
Yeah, we're getting him on the show. We'll get him to come on and admit it himself. Well, you know, Bob, you in your speech did have some important things to say, and since you get a second chance here, where most commencement speakers don't. Let's talk a little bit about what you did have to say. Figure out what makes you happy, which isn't necessarily somebody's job. In your case, in some ways it was, but you urge people to really figure out what makes them happy. That sounds simple enough, but what did you mean?
Well, you know, I want to give them some lessons. I know a lot of people give certainly numbers of lessons, which I wanted to do as well. I just had a great one. I went to Colgate. My son just graduated this year. From Colgate, where I went, and Duncan Netterauer was the director of the New York Stock Exchange, and he spelled out 13 lessons in life. All of them were very creative, mixed together humor with real information and instructions to do. And so I wanted to do the same in mind, which I did the year before. And you know, certain things in life, it's true that I wanted to tell about what had happened to me. Yes, I needed to say what I had witnessed when I was hit by a bomb, just to give them a thought about life can be very unexpected and your life can change in an instant. I remember we also talked about exercising your faith, which is also a very important one in life, and also, to serve and give back. I think sometimes people concentrate a lot of their life on what they will get, and not necessarily what they will give back until they reach that point where maybe they got enough money, they got enough confidence, or they're old enough and finished all their accomplishments. But there's nothing more satisfying than give something back. And then absolutely your family. You know, don't forget who is paying that tuition right there. And you can't thank them enough either for putting you on this earth and maintaining your life as you go. So those are lessons that I thought were important.
And you asked people to thank their family verbally and be vocal with them that very day.
Yeah, that's right. Just turn to that person. You know, they're not sitting next to you during the commencement, but they're right there in the stadium with you. Just take a look and look at them and remind them that you will never forget them. You will forget me, what I said in this commencement speech, but never forget your parents and what they've done in life, even when you got those battles every once in a while.
Award-winning journalist Bob Woodruff sustained near-fatal injuries while reporting in Iraq in 2006. He gave a commencement speech at Boston College, unofficially one of the best. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, more grisly news, this time from London, where it's now been confirmed that the man brutally hacked to death by two attackers carrying machetes was a serving British soldier. Debate is now underway in the UK whether to raise the country's terrorism threat level. This all follows a shocking murder carried out by suspects shouting jihadist slogans in southeast London. Now, according to one eyewitness, the two people who murdered the soldier acted like they wanted to get caught. Here's an eyewitness, Joe Tallant, speaking to the BBC. Listen.
They could have easily got away from that, from the space that the police come. They could have just walked off, gone about their business, and then got caught later. But they were just walking around the body like they was wanting the police to come and get it.
That's eyewitness Joe Tallant speaking to the BBC. The concern now is whether Wednesday's assault near an army barracks could lead to more attacks. Joining us is Leslie Ashmal, a BBC reporter, BBC Radio 5 reporter. Hi, Leslie.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Well, authorities there have described this as an act of terror. What do we know about the attackers at this point that points to that?
You know, like the Boston Marathon, this has just absolutely appalled London. We don't know a very great deal about the men responsible yet. We know that they carried out this brutal and brazen attack in broad daylight, 2:30 in the afternoon. And as you say, it seems like they wanted to get caught. They drove their car up onto a pavement, knocking down this man we know now is a soldier. He was wearing a Help for Heroes t-shirt. That's a charity which supports the armed forces here. He was run over, they got out, and, you know, they hacked him to death in front of, you know, hundreds of shoppers. This is one of London's busiest roads. It's very close to a school. It is very close to the army barracks. And then they hung around. I mean, you may have seen footage on the internet. They're shouting to people. They're shouting to people to film them, to take their photographs. They wanted their message to get across, they said. They kept saying, we're very sorry women and children had to see this, but in our country, this is what happens, and women and children have to see it there too. Now, we don't really know much about them. Truth be known, we think they're from Nigerian origin, but we think they have been brought up and lived in London. One of them has quite a clear South London accent, so we don't know a great deal. The police did shoot them. One of them's in quite a serious condition in hospital. They're both under armed guard. And as I understand it, the intelligence services are hoping to speak to them later on today.
There's no reason to believe that the soldier who was murdered was specifically targeted, that he was just a target perhaps of a broader agenda, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. It was very near a very large army barracks. In fact, actually, Woolwich is where the shooting took place at the London Olympics, is the shooting sport, because there's such a big association with the army and with the artillery in that part of London. There used to be a foundry there which made guns way back into the 17th and 18th century. So it's a very famous kind of army site there, and it wouldn't have been too hard to find a military personnel in that area. And it does seem on the face of it, certainly, that they have just waited to find a victim.
Leslie Ashnall, before we let you go, there has to be fear in the community and across London that this kind of attack could be repeated.
They've stepped up security at all the army barracks, and I think people are just being very British about it, stiff upper lip, getting on with it, just as they did in Boston.
A grisly attack, more grisly news, this time from London, of an attack by two people on a British Army soldier, leaving him dead in the street. Leslie Ashmal, BBC Radio 5 live reporter, thank you for the update.
No problem.
We appreciate it. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This week, the American Psychiatric Association unveiled the fifth edition of what's called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. That's known shortly as DSM-5, the fifth version. Yesterday, we spoke to Dr. Alan Francis, who helped write the fourth edition of the DSM. He's since become a major critic. Listen.
We have a crazy system in which non-experts are doing most of the prescribing after very short visits without really knowing the patient. The intervention is given way too early, and often once a diagnosis is given, it's very hard to take away. Once medicine is started, even if it's unnecessary, it'll be given for a very, very long time.
Now, we're hearing from you on this. Cindy, a counselor in Seattle, is concerned about the rigid categories in mental health diagnosis. Cindy wrote this on thetakeaway.org. Since each person and his or her immediate life contexts are unique, of course, the designation of mental illness is quite arbitrary and ephemeral. It's sad that so many people see mental illness as an open or shut door. They think you should either have it or you don't, but it's not so, not at all. Well, our next guest, the incoming president of the American Psychiatric Association, says all of his criticism is unwarranted. He's Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman. He's chair of psychiatry at Columbia University here in New York. Thanks for joining us, doctor.
My pleasure.
Now, Dr. Lieberman, I started my career in the medical trade press at a paper called Clinical Psychiatry News. The DSM-3 was controversial then. The DSM-5 is even more controversial now. What is it about the labeling and categorization of these mental disorders that has so many people, including your colleagues, writing it off?
Well, it is controversial, but frankly, it shouldn't be. The DSM is simply a guide which is created to assist clinicians, mental health care, and healthcare providers to recognize signs and symptoms in people who are suffering from disturbances in mental function or behavioral problems in order to establish the most accurate diagnoses and guide treatment. And the fifth edition of DSM-5 represents what is an updating and a modest revision to the previous versions. As to why it's created this great deal of attention and debate and controversy, I think the root of it is really that the notion of mental illness has historically been not well understood and largely been stigmatized. And this makes any change in something that is a subject of some sensitivity something of great attention, and people have different opinions.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, of course, the stigma of mental illness has been a major problem for centuries. Millions, hundreds of millions of people who could have used treatment never got it, and that's tragic. As you know, on the other side of this coin is a book that now suggests that half of us walking around could have a diagnosable disorder, and maybe the opposite side of the coin, from stigmatization is labeling everybody. Hey, everyone's a candidate. And by the way, everyone's a candidate to avail themselves of our industry. You understand that skepticism?
Right. But let me just say that it's just flatly wrong to say that the development or refinement of the diagnostic manual is an effort to pathologize normal behavior, to expand the number of the population that get diagnosis. That's absolutely untrue. We all are at risk for various illnesses, whether it's the flu, pneumonia, hypertension, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease. The process of trying to refine the diagnosis is to make them ever more accurate and more representative of the true condition which is being caused by disturbances of the brain or the effects of environment on mental function. If you look at the history of medical science and the evolution of the International Classification of Diseases, which is produced by the World Health Organization and is the diagnostic system that all physicians in all countries utilize for all disease areas, that has, and it's currently in its 10th edition, that has increased by 8%. Per new edition. This is the nature of science. In 1840, when the U.S. made its first attempt to determine the frequency of disease and mental dysfunction in the population, it had two diagnoses, idiocy and insanity. And since then, medical research has enabled the different forms of intellectual disability that are genetically or environmentally caused to be disentangled into autism, into Prader-Willi syndrome, into Rett syndrome, into Down syndrome. And insanity has been disentangled through research into schizophrenia, into bipolar disorder, into depression. It's the nature of progress. The DSM-5 doesn't have any more diagnoses than DSM-4 have. It didn't expand the pie. It simply sliced the pie into more precise pieces.
So more refinement, and we understand so much more than we used to, and that point is clear. But look, Dr. Lieberman, the National Institutes for Mental Health has said they won't be using your manual. You're aware of that. One of the criticisms, especially coming from the rapidly expanding world of neuroscience, is that all of these diagnoses, while valuable, don't say enough about the brain. They don't say enough about treatment and about neuropsychological treatments and don't really guide professionals in effective treatment. They just put sticky labels on everything.
Psychiatrists in general and the DSM task force specifically would have liked nothing more when they began this effort 10 years ago to have had genes, diagnostic laboratory tests, x-rays, electrophysiologic measures that could be used to diagnose the conditions or to attach the diagnosis of schizophrenia, depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, to specific neurobiologic factors. That would have been the greatest advance that we could have hoped for. But they pored over the literature, all the scientific evidence, and unfortunately, scientific progress has not brought us to that point. The brain is a very complex organ. Mental disorders are disturbances of the most highly evolved parts of the brain, and they've proved to be challenging. I wish the NIMH's research budget were doubled or tripled so that we could make more rapid progress, and that would occasion a more substantive change in the DSM.
The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders of the American Psychiatric Association, has always been controversial. That controversy has increased and is probably larger than ever with the new release of DSM-5, the fifth edition. Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman is chair of psychiatry at Columbia University and the incoming president of the American Psychiatric Association. Dr. Lieberman, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Well, hoping to turn the tide in what has become an escalating drone program, President Obama will begin restricting the use of unmanned drone strikes. The major policy shift comes as the U.S. acknowledged for the first time formally that its drone program has killed 4 Americans abroad. Want to turn now to the other side of this story and how the use of drones has affected the perception of America abroad. Hussein Rashid is professor of religion at Hofstra University. He recently returned from Pakistan, where the locals talked to him about how U.S. security efforts affect them. Hussein, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
It's good to have you. So you've just been in Pakistan. Look, U.S. drone policy, which is the, for better or for worse, the flagship effort of our anti-terror effort, it's become such in places like Pakistan and Yemen, has been going on for 10 years, if not longer. People have been living with this. What have they been telling you about how this has affected their lives, maybe more importantly, their attitudes towards the United States?
You know, I think we understand a lot about what's happening in Pakistan and in Yemen because a lot of reports have come out in the last couple of weeks. People hearing drones, people being afraid and trying to understand living with that fear. But it was something very different for me to actually be there and hear the ways in which people's lives are affected, even in urban areas where these drones supposedly are not operating, that there really is a palpable sense of fear. And that fear is creating a sense of resentment against America. At the same time, I will say that a lot of Pakistanis also realize how complicit the Pakistani government is in this. I think what we have to, as Americans, be conscious of is that we really don't have a clear policy. You know, the administration has on again, off again denied the existence of this program. We have media reports on it. We have memos on it, but still it doesn't officially exist. I think we need to be conscious of the fact that what is happening overseas not only has potential foreign policy blowback, but has implications for domestic policy, because it's a question of the rule of law, in my opinion.
Well, today it is being acknowledged by the president, U.S. drone policy in several ways, and I want to ask you about the implications of that change. But when people are cognizant of it in Pakistan, for instance, we've heard so much about areas where terrorists, al-Qaeda, whatever we're calling them, are operating, where there might be collateral damage. A wedding gets targeted accidentally, or somebody who's near a terrorist becomes collateral damage. If you live in Karachi, probably not so much. The average Pakistani has real fear that you're saying that they could be on the wrong end of a Hellfire missile, or do they just have a generalized sense that their country's being targeted? Because those are two very different things.
I think they're related. I think there's a general sense that country is being targeted. Absolutely, right? So this is a question of, imagine if something happened in the middle of a field where nobody lived for 100 miles in America. We would still be up in arms. It's an attack on our nation. But I think we also have to realize that, yes, a lot of these bombings are happening in the so-called tribal areas that are not under Pakistani government control. But when we look at these terrorists are like rats. So if you start sinking the operations where they are, they start moving. And then they start moving into urban areas like Karachi, where you see a lot of urban violence from these terrorists. You know, people were openly telling me from Karachi, were saying, we are afraid to go pray because we don't know if we'll be shot by these people. And they see that as, you know, why are we not fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here? Very similar rhetoric to what we hear.
And there's a fear then, I'm extrapolating from that, there's a fear that I don't want to go to market or to mosque or down the street because I might be standing next to the wrong guy who's in a crosshairs.
Very much like that. And you said, you know, accidentally targeting a wedding. But we've read reports where it seems we've actually intentionally targeted funerals because we suspect high-profile targets will be there. Again, all of this is unofficial, but if you're targeting a funeral, you're going to hit innocent people.
Now, at the same time, these dynamics are something that our government says that they're aware of. If not drones per se, the impact on citizens and their perception of the United States as we fight this war on terror and have for the last 10 or more years. The State Department spends millions, if not billions, with their own efforts trying to counteract this fear and this bad feeling towards the United States. Programs, cultural programs, academic programs, as you know, probably far better than I, where we're also spending a lot of money sort of on the diplomatic, cultural, soft power end of American outreach. Is it canceled out completely by people's fear or anger about drones and the military aspect, or is it helping? What's your sense of how people react to that in a place like Pakistan?
I think you're absolutely right. I think there really is there's a zero-sum game here. You know, for every positive interaction that is made by the State Department, a drone strike will wipe that out, even the rumor of a drone strike. And when I was in Pakistan, I was not there in a State Department capacity. I was there with a multi-faith NGO. You know, there was a real sense of skepticism that we were Americans coming over. Are we working for the government? Which government are we working for? And a lot of the trust-building time was spent saying we are not here as representatives of any government. We are here as peace builders. And there was really a sense that they could not trust anybody who came from a State Department trip.
Well, that's a hard message to convey to somebody when they're looking you in the eye and you say, I'm here on a peace-building mission, and they're wondering what eye is flying overhead.
Yeah. Well, I made a sarcastic tweet before I left for Pakistan. I'm Shia. You know, am I more likely to get killed by a drone or a sectarian bullet while I'm in Pakistan? But you get on the ground and you realize this really is a palpable fear for so many people.
Well, sarcasm aside, what do you think is the answer?
I think that one of the things that we as Americans have to be responsible for is the question of accountability, transparency, and legality of these drone strikes. When Attorney General Eric Holder says to us last night says to us the day before President Obama's national security speech that, we've killed four Americans by drones, only one of which we targeted, you know, all sorts of red flags should be going up. Well, how do we decide who gets attacked? Does it matter if it's an American or a non-American? What are the rules of war? How do we decide if somebody is guilty without a trial, which is enshrined in our Constitution? And I think we've got to understand this has implications back in America. When the LAPD officer, Dornan, had gone on a shooting spree earlier this year, people were talking about using drones against him. Drones against American citizens who have not been found guilty of any crime. This should really concern us, that if we can't apply the rule of law at home and we can't apply the rule of law abroad, how can we say we're a nation of laws?
That episode with the LAPD officer sort of happened at the same time that people were talking about the national security implications of the Alaki targeting. So those two things kind of had a confluence of events, and it became logical to some people to use a domestic drone. But before we let you go, Professor Hussein Rashid, we're hearing today that U.S. drone policy is not only being acknowledged, but is being changed, altered, at least as it applies to the Americans like you discussed. I'm not sure, maybe you can help us understand whether a tightening of U.S. drone policy or at least a public acknowledgement that it exists and that it is operating helps to begin to change these perceptions that you're talking about, or is it only a function of the number of drones, the number of hellfires, the number of dead in a place like Pakistan that affects their perception of this program? Does what the president has to say today matter?
I think it absolutely does have to matter. The reality is drones are now with us. They are part of our modern arsenal. And I don't think we're going to give them up anytime soon. I think what we need to do to demonstrate is that there are laws and procedures. We have accountability for their usage, and that we as Americans can now have an open debate about their role in how unmanned vehicles represent Americans abroad, because we've got to understand these machines now represent us.
Hussein Rashid is professor of religion at Hofstra University, recently returned from Pakistan. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.